The principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
Mrs. Pearl Bell is a literary critic for Commentary Magazine. She keeps an eye on current American fiction. Joining in our discussion is Dr. Kent Mulliken, Assistant Director of the National Humanities Center. Mrs. Bell, welcome to Soundings. In your view, what's the status of American writing?
I think that at the moment, a good deal of that 60s sense of the apocalypse of the world coming to an end, of everything running down and being in a state of total chaos, is no longer as prevalent among writers in America now as it had been. And it's hard to see any one distinct mood or one distinct direction in which it's going. As invariably happens in any period, most of the novels that I'm sent by Commentary to look at or ask for aren't any good. I don't read beyond the first 10 pages of it. There will always be, even in a period that one doesn't think of as a very flourishing one for fiction or for literature or for the arts in general, there are always a number of things that are being done by individual talents which are remarkable and very much worth reading. I think at the moment there isn't very much of that going on. I think that in the past 2 years I have praised without qualification only 1.5 books. The half that I praised was half of Sophie's Choice. The other half I didn't praise at all, which isn't a very high batting average, I'll admit. But at the same time, when I was writing for the New Leader in 69, I don't think I liked very many books there. But that's part, I like to think that my standards are very high and very severe. But I think at the moment there just isn't anything terribly interesting going on, with, as I say, the usual kinds of exceptions. I'm sorry.
Yeah, before Wayne asks it, let me get to my first question. Yeah. I think it's appropriate at this point. What makes a good novel? This is an obvious question, but what do you look for when you read?
I look for a distinct sense of the, to use that overworked word, but I can't think of a better one, of the sensibility of the writer. You look for an original mind, an original approach to the experience that is being written about. And with that, part of that originality, of course, is the way in which he or she uses the language. But what you have to get almost from the start is a sense of this being something different from the usual run of novels that one sees. And if you get that sense, and it can sometimes be a very faint sense of that, then you are willing to follow that writer's work all the way through to the end of a particular book. But if I feel, say, in reading the first 3 or 4 or maybe even 15 pages of a novel, that they are relying on sort of cliches, not only of language, but of feeling and of intellect, then I don't really want to bother with it, because I feel it's just the same old thing. In other words, I look immediately for that, it's such a hard thing to describe, and I'm not sure that I can describe it very specifically now, but it, you just want to get this, let me give you an example. There's a novel called The World According to Garp by John Irving, which has a great many things wrong with it. There's a lot wrong with the way he looks at the world. But from the moment I began reading that book, I knew that this was an original mind, that there was something going on in this book, going on in the mind and the emotions of this writer, which I hadn't seen before in quite this way. And although I didn't give it unqualified praise, that originality plus his very strong feeling for family life, which is something that I always respond to in fiction because there's so little of it today. Most novelists of the last 15 years have been very much anti-family and anti-nature in general. I just realized that this was something that I very much wanted to get involved with and to read and also to write about. I think that's the main thing I look for. The sheer quality of the writing sometimes is what can immediately grip one's attention. For example, a novel by Mary Gordon called Final Payments, I don't know, it's about a Catholic girl in New York. She writes so beautifully that even though some of her responses are conventional, responses and some of her shaping of experience is conventional, particularly in the second half of the book, I was so charmed and impressed by the quality of her imagery, for example, and the way she can form a sentence. That again, I felt that this was an original piece of work. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. I have another one though. Yeah. One of the classical criteria for judging a work of literature is how long it has appealed. Mm-hmm. What has pleased many and pleased long, mm-hmm. Samuel Johnson
yes, yes.
said.
Mm-hmm. It.
And that, do you ever ask yourself when you're reading a book that comes in from mm-hmm. an unknown writer? Mm-hmm. What will people think of this book in the 21st century? Is that
it's a dangerous question to ask because my answer would almost invariably have to be they won't know about it at all. Diana Trilling did a regular fiction column for The Nation. I don't know if you know that. And last year there was collected all the reviews that she had done. It was called Reviewing the 40s, and it was the ones that she most wanted to have preserved. And what I found very poignant in a way were the number of writers, the number of novels that, even though this is a mere 35 or 40 years ago, which have absolutely disappeared. Writers who wrote one or two books and never wrote again were the novels themselves, which I have been out of print almost as long as they've been in existence. It's a very tricky question to ask. You never can really tell. I mean, I think that one of the things that is very difficult about that contemporary fiction is that a good deal of its effects depend on the particular the rather modish slang of our time, which changes so radically and so rapidly that it would be incomprehensible, say, 100 years from now, when an entirely different kind of jivey talk would have come in. And that in itself would present a problem. I mean, on the other hand, when you think that Dickens certainly used the slang of his time, and it hasn't kept anyone from understanding what he was doing or appreciating his books. So, as I say, it's a hard question to answer, but I would suspect that almost all the books that have come out that I've been reviewing or reading in the last 15 years will not have a very long run so far as immortality goes.
I'd like to use you as a sounding board. Mm-hmm. One critic has said that he looks for or listens for the sound of a human voice mm-hmm. coming off of the page to determine, I guess, what you had in mind when you said the writer's sensibility or a fine sensibility.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Would you respond to that, comment on that?
Well, it depends on the writer. There are some writers like Philip Roth and this writer that I, the new writer that I mentioned the other day, Johanna Kaplan, whose ears, and Salinger is another example, whose ears are the most important sense they have, and who can pick up the human voices they hear, it as the different locutions and ways of speech of different classes, different groups, different kinds of people. I think the term human voice is too loose, too amorphous, really, to be a very usable criterion. I certainly do look for a particular writer's voice.
Uh-huh. I think that's what.
Well, a particular writer's voice can sometimes be very distinctive indeed. I mean, you can always know when you open something by Salinger, even though I think there are he has many shortcomings, that this is a Salinger page. I mean, it's unmistakable, just as Faulkner is unmistakable, or Hemingway, early Hemingway at any rate, is unmistakable. But the writers writing today, I'm not sure how many of them have that absolute distinctness, that immediate recognizability, which is like a fingerprint, you know. I don't know whether any of them have it.
Would you say that America has a representative writer today?
No.
If you could...
Certainly not. I mean,
a kind of writer.
And curious, I don't think America ever has had a representative writer. The whole of the American tradition has always been one of loneliness for the artist particularly. And I don't think Melville was representative at his time, or that Hawthorne. Also, the regionalism of America makes it very difficult. The separation of this country into so many very distinct regions makes it impossible to see any one writer as representative. I think a writer can be representative of a region, as Faulkner was, say, in the 40s and 50s, as Eudora Welty was of a certain part of Mississippi. I think there are certain New York writers who are very much the representative writers of that period. But as I say, it's a rather tricky kind of question, because I'm not sure that any who represent everything, even about a particular region at this point, because life has become so fragmented in the modern world that it's very hard to say what would be represented.
Well, given that that mix that you're talking about, who would you say is doing the best writing
today?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think Saul Bellow is the best writer in America today. I think he represents only himself, I mean, except to the extent that he represents a certain kind of Jewish writer who comes out of an immigrant Jewish background. But I think he has both the intelligence and the passion and the compassion, that all of which go to making up a very fine writer. And he does have a very distinctive voice. You know the moment you read him that that sardonic kind of wisecracking diction is very much his. It's not as unmistakable, say, as Salinger, but it is a very distinct kind of diction. Who else? I think that Philip Roth's last book promises that he may become an important writer one day rather than a merely sensational one. Who else?
What about writers like Wallace Stegner? Where would you put a man like that?
Well, I've always had trouble with Stegner because I respect him without admiring him, if that's a valid distinction. I think his books are honest. They're very well crafted. They are occasionally amusing. There was one that he wrote about old age in California, which I thought was very touching. I forget what the name of it was. It came out about 4 years ago.
Not Angle of Repose.
No, it wasn't Angle. It was one after that.
Recapitulation.
Maybe it was Angle of Repose. Wait a minute. It was the one about the man. It's narrated by a man who is constantly complaining about the...
He's in a wheelchair.
Yes.
Angle of Repose.
But none of his novels that I've ever read has impressed me as a major work of art. And I find it rather a pity that I can't admire him more than I do, because there's so much there that is valuable. And I gather he's a very great teacher. I've known people who've been his students. But as a novelist, I think he's not first rate.
Mm-hmm.
Not first rate.
Yeah.
You spoke a while ago about the politicization of literature at Brooklyn College when you were a student. Do you think that literature, the criticism of literature, tends to be politicized in any respect today?
Well, it was, I think, in the 60s and through a good deal of the 70s. I think it's much less true now. In the same way that, for example, the students are no longer as disruptive and rebellious and angry against the system, and this great abstraction, and have become much more serious and much more concerned with their economic futures and all the other things that go with, I think, with growing up. I think that the critics of literature now are less inclined to apply political standards. But in the 60s and in the 70s, this was going on all the time, particularly in the New York Review of Books, which I had a very specific political point of view, and was only too eager to have it corroborated in the criticism of fiction and poetry, as well as in the criticism of straight political books.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
Dr. Steve Pine is a young scholar of the history of American science who did his graduate work at the University of Texas. He spends his summers working for the United States Forest Service, fighting fires at the north rim of the Grand Canyon. Dr. Pine has written a biography of Grove Carl Gilbert, the American geologist, and while on a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, he completed a history of wild land and rural fire in the United States to be published soon by Princeton University Press. Pine is interested in the lore and literature of fire and in environmentalism. Dr. Pine, welcome to Soundings. I wonder if you'd discuss your scholarly interest in fire.
Well, fire is a natural event, has great antiquity. Fire and life share a common chemistry of carbon. Pyrolysis is simply the reverse reaction of photosynthesis, speed it up a little bit. Fire and life share a common geographic range. You don't find fire where you don't have living organisms, particularly terrestrial. And they probably have a common origin in lightning. And as far back as we really have records of organic terrestrial life, we have records of fire. There are fire scars in the petrified logs of petrified national forest. The sooty part of coal, even back into Paleozoic times, is really a charcoal. It's the residue of ancient fires. So the antiquity of fire and its role in evolution is very prominent. And goes back for geologic eons.
In other words, it's almost an artificial distinction to say that classify fire as a physical and a cultural phenomenon.
Well, in a sense, but we have to realize that however fire is manipulated by mankind, it has to operate within certain parameters, and those parameters are set by nature. Mm-hmm. In other words, how fire functions, how it has worked out adaptations with natural communities and so forth. Set limits on what you can do and can't do. A good way to think about fire as a natural phenomenon is to think about it as a manifestation of climate. Clearly, if lightning is the ignition source, then it comes together. And fire, like floods, tend to show the same energy profile in many ways. So you have 50 or 100 year fires the same way that you have 50 or 100 year floods. Many small fires and a very few large fires. Most of the damage today, even considering fire suppression activities, perhaps 95% of the damage is coming from less than 5% of the fires.
You talked about fire seasons. What are they? When do they occur?
Well, they vary by region. Fire, you'll recall, can be considered as a climatic phenomenon, particularly if you're dealing with lightning fire. It's wholly climatic. Mm-hmm. And certain times favor fires. Because it's dry, windy, so forth. The vegetation may have dried out, and so forth. So seasons vary. Usually there is, in general, one can speak of a spring and a fall season. And in the east, most of the really large fires have occurred in April, when you have the passage of dry cold fronts moving through. It causes a wind shift. Dry air, very windy, and so forth. So you'll have a fire burning in advance of this front with the prevailing winds out of the south-southwest, and it will begin, the fire burns as a kind of ellipse, and it will be driven by the wind, but the minute the front passes, you have this very broad ellipse, and the fire will now move along the major axis of the ellipse. So you can it's a mechanism for very large fires. And most of the fires in the coastal plains of the east, the large fires have occurred in April or under these conditions. Other fires have occurred in the late fall during prolonged Indian summer conditions with a drought of some sort. You usually don't have the wind. You tend to have a lot of acres burned, but not necessarily a dramatic wildfire. In South Florida, for example, the fire season is in the winter. You have relatively dry lightning storms, and most of the fires in the Everglades are started by these. And the grass has dried out at that point. It's too wet in the summer to burn. So you have a winter fire season. In the Southwest, the spring fire season comes in mid-May or so, to early June, when you develop a kind of monsoon or the summer rainy pattern, which begins drafting moisture in. And from the Gulf of Mexico. It crosses the mountains, creates a lot of lightning storms. Frequently, there is not enough moisture for the rain to reach the ground. So you have what's called a dry lightning storm, a lot of lightning, very little rain, and of course you get a lot of fires. And again, in the fall, if you have a prolonged inversion, you may have a fire season. During the summer, there's simply too much rain for most fires to escape. In Southern California, the major fire season, of course, coincides with the advent of the Santa Ana winds. And the Santa Ana winds are part of a large family of fall or phone winds.
Fall winds.
Right, because they tend to come in the fall.
From when, August on?
No, from late September, perhaps generally October through December, the major season. So most of the big Southern California fires are in, say, November and December, actually, a much later time than others. As I say, these are a category of winds, also called gravity winds, and they build up in the interior, in the intermountain area, the Great Basin, between the Rockies to the east and the Sierra Cascades on the west. And under prevailing high pressure cells, the air in this area literally builds up. It's kind of dammed by these mountains and eventually spills over the side. So it's a kind of a flood or avalanche of air is what you have, and they may persist for 2 or 3 days. So in California, they're known as the Santa Anas. Northern California is the Mono or North Wind. In the northwest is the East Wind. East of the Rockies is the Chinook.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk briefly about urban fires? Where are the greatest areas of danger, threat? Is it Southern California?
Yeah. The situation with urban fires is kind of interesting because we really don't have large urban conflagrations as such. The last group came around 1904 to maybe 1920, perhaps 1923 when a good portion of Berkeley burned was the last major urban conflagration. But fire codes, building practices, and so forth have pretty much eliminated large urban conflagrations. What we have, however, is a mixture of wild and urban lands, which is very deadly. In effect, it's neither one nor the other. It's sort of taking the worst of both. And in Southern California, you have perhaps the most spectacular example of this with the chaparral. The chaparral is a plant which is quite well adapted to fire, encourages fire. At about to age 25 to 30, it begins increasing the proportion of dead branches to live branches. During the fire season, tends to exude a kind of vapor, which encourages the flammability. It recovers very nicely, simply resprouts after it's been burned. So it's a way of maintaining itself. So within this, without eliminating all of these plants, you are beginning to build houses. You're beginning to build houses with wood shingle roofs, which is the greatest single reason why urban conflagrations have been eliminated, namely that the roofs are no longer flammable. And you put into this problems of topography, inaccessibility. Many of these residential areas are designed to be exclusive, and one of the things that they exclude is fire protection of any adequate sort. And you mix all of these things up. You have Santa Ana winds, and you have arson, and you have a situation which is almost impossible to prevent large fires from occurring, almost inevitable. And this situation, however, is being repeated in many other areas on a less dramatic scale, particularly with the introduction of summer homes, recreational homes, and so forth in forested areas where the people don't live there year-round. So you have a question of what kind of fire protection can you provide? Who's going to provide it? How much are they willing to pay for it? And so forth. And yet, in fact, they're encouraging the growth of flammable vegetation around the house. I mean, that's part of the attraction of having the summer home. And you're really building a fire hazard which would never be tolerated in an urban environment. So this problem is actually very much on the increase and may be one of the controlling fire problems of the future. Again, because of the counter-reclamation, rural land is in great upheaval. Much of it is, we don't need to put it all into farms. Much of it is being converted or half converted to suburb or various kinds of semi-recreational homes. A lot of it is simply being left as weed lots or unmanaged forest land. In other words, when you have a fully reclaimed agricultural landscape, their fire hazard decreases. I mean, the fuels have been arranged, but now we're allowing all these fuels to build back up. We're removing the incentive for people to protect them and so forth. And a rural fire is, in fact, a very prominent problem. Most of the worst fire disasters in the country, it may be worth recalling, occurred in rural landscapes in the 19th century. And we are, in a sense, recreating many of those landscapes. The forests have recovered, increased, and we're creating small villages and homes and so forth out in the woods, and this may in fact become a serious problem.
I wonder if you could give me some thoughts on your notion of environmentalism and fire. I know that environmentalism is unfair. It isn't all one monolithic movement. Is it good? Is it bad? What's the interaction between fire policy and the so-called environmentalist movement, the Sierra Club, things
right.
like that.
Right. Well, I think you have to discriminate again between different historical periods. And I discriminate between two. The first conservation era, late 19th century, early 20th, corresponding what historians would call the progressive era. And fire protection was very much a fundamental component of this. As I interpret that period, the reaction is against frontier practices and against, in many cases, agricultural reclamation in favor of a kind of industrial society where the resources will be rationally consumed and managed, a kind of engineering approach. Waste will be eliminated and so forth. And in this context, in fact, that context was very much one of the important components in establishing a fire protection system in the first place, to eliminate this kind of waste. As a kind of the reaction against the agricultural reclamation. But I think what's happened now is that we've created a kind of what I would call a counter-reclaimed landscape, the landscape of the Industrial Revolution. And in managing that, we've created other kinds of problems. And with respect to that landscape, we are seeing new land use policies which have required a reevaluation of fire policy. But I think the other thing is that there is a different kind of environmentalism than that which I described earlier, beginning perhaps with the problem of atomic fallout, going on to pesticides and chemical pollutants of various kinds and so forth. We're dealing with increasingly the synthetic landscape, not trying to rationalize natural resources or programs which relate to forests and watersheds and range and all of these kinds of things, logging, but really to the products of the synthetic landscape, the things people are creating and applying to their own synthetically made landscape. And in this respect, I think it's a very different kind of movement. And in this respect, fire protection has come, I think, to be seen as an encroachment, as a human artifact which has encroached on the wild state.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation, in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the center is William Bennett. Soundings is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Bill Bennett, director of the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Ideas are the business of the National Humanities Center, and I'd like to invite you to listen for some of them on Soundings, a series of conversations with the men and women of the center. This week, Soundings looks at two topics, current American fiction and environmentalism, in conversations with Pearl Bell, a first-rate literary critic, and with Dr. Stephen Pine, a bright young scholar who spends his summers fighting fires at the Grand Canyon. I hope you'll be listening for Soundings.